Well, I should begin by with a question. Was Jinnah a global thinker? He's certainly a hugely consequential figure in South Asia, but he seems to have lost out in the race for global thinker status, perhaps through no fault of his own. He's been overshadowed, rightly or wrongly, by his contemporaries Gandhi and indeed even Nehru. But perhaps Jinnah's time is yet to come, because he may arguably be considered to be the founder of Muslim politics as a modern phenomenon, more than anyone else. And yet today, he's been forgotten largely not only in the West, but also in the Muslim world itself. He has never been a particularly important global thinker. But let's see in the 10-20 minutes I'm meant to speak whether there's something that can be recovered from his career, whether he is something more than a footnote, if albeit a very large fonted footnote in history. So this talk will be in two parts. The first part will be a kind of background to Muslim nationalism, and then I'll talk about Jinnah's own contribution to it. So let's begin with a consideration of nationalism, which has been, or rather become, an important subject of scholarly inquiry over the past couple of decades, 2-3 decades at the most. Now, most of the great works on nationalism tend to deal with it in a kind of triumphalist mode. You know, whether it is Partha Chatterjee's work, whose problem is to figure out if nationalism was a derivative form, or from the West, or Benedict Anderson's earlier work, which of course stressed the importance of modularity, of the nation as a kind of modular form that got replicated all over the world. But in our own day, perhaps we can recognize that nationalism is no longer, or may no longer be, as triumphalist a political form as we had thought not so long ago. And this is one place in which Muslim nationalism becomes an important intervention, I think, because it questions the form that it adopts in quite distinctive ways. So instead of looking at triumphalist modular forms of nationalism, what if we consider a kind of reluctant nationalism, a kind of shy and diffident and self-critical form of nationalism, which is not the kind of thing that the scholars of the nation form have really seriously considered? Then, in the 1930s and 40s, as much as now, I think, it's this division between blood and guts, full-throated, full-blown nationalism on the one hand, all about sovereignty, blood and soil belonging, etc., and this shy, diffident, by shy I don't mean weak or non-violent, by the way, this self-critical form of nationalism, whose rise or revival we see before us today. All you have to do is think about this country, where you have, on the one hand, as an expression of old-fashioned sovereign-inclined nationalism, UKIP, which wants to claim independence for an independent country, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the Scottish Nationalist Party, whose idea of nationalism lacks sovereignty, indeed lacks even a currency of its own, whether it's Scotland or Catalonia or other such forms within the EU. They are only made possible by the EU. Right? In a way, the EU strangely allows for the development of new kinds of nations which are not fully sovereign, which do not require full sovereignty, which are made possible because they are part of a larger federal unit, which don't require their own currency. Remember, Scotland would either share the British pound, would share sterling, or it would, in some possible world, adopt the euro. These other forms of nationalism are also not particularly keen. They're not keen on sovereignty in the fulsome sense of the 19th and early to, first half of the 20th century. Nor are they particularly keen on blood and soil types of belonging. They seem to be much friendlier to almost a kind of municipal sense of nationality. So we see this battle between two forms of the nation state or national identity being waged before us today. What I want to suggest to you is that colonial India is the place where this battle, one of the places where this battle emerges for the first time. Because if you think about the Indian National Congress, it draws upon the victorious form of the nation state, right? And the to our days, the more rational form of it. What is this nation? It's defined by a long history, by historical continuity, real or imaginary. It doesn't matter, as those of you who have read Ernst Renan will know, that the nation is no less real if it is imagined. Right? So historical continuity and geographical unity. And the people who live in that nation or who are its citizens are bound together by geography and history. And they might share other things like blood or race or religion or language, right? Often a combination of all of these things together. So that on the one hand. With Muslim nationalism, especially that articulated by the Muslim League from the 1930s, you have the converse phenomenon. You have a situation in which the nation state, we'll come to the nation state later, but the nation is not defined by either history or indeed in some ways even geography. Because of course to do so would link this Muslim nation, eventually Pakistan, back to India. India always has a prior claim to history and geography. Pakistan cannot claim those things without being reabsorbed. Because after all, it's a shared history and it's a shared geography. And when you look at the Pakistan movement, what's fascinating about this, about it, is it makes very little in the way of historical precedents or claims. Jinnah himself is not particularly interested in history. The historical claims that are made are superficial at best, and even when they are meant with some degree of seriousness, actually gesture to the universal history of Islam, not the history of a particular nation. The arrival, equally imaginary, of Muhammad bin Qasim is not exactly the beginning of Pakistan. Right? Muhammad bin Qasim belongs to a much bigger history. It cannot be reduced to Pakistani history. It just doesn't work. Similarly, if you look at in the 30s and 40s, the geography of this imagined Pakistan, it's all over the map, literally. Chaudhry Rehmat Ali, the Cambridge undergraduate who comes up with the name Pakistan, if you were to look at his maps, he produces many maps. They are extraordinary. They are scattered all over the subcontinent. This is not a nation state in any standard sense. Right? It's literally splitting up colonial India into different fragments. And there are bits of it, Pakistan is the name given to one bit of it, and then there are other bits of it, which may or may not be part of Pakistan. So there's Akhutistan, the homeland of those people formerly known as untouchables. And that's in what is today UP, right, the United Provinces. So that heartland of Muslim culture, North Indian Muslim culture, is actually given away by Chaudhry Rehmat Ali to Dalits. It's not even claimed for Islam, right? Very interesting. There is Osmanistan, which is of course the former princely state of Hyderabad, and there are other such things. So here is the idea of a state or a nation, national territory, that really does not belong in the conventional vision of nationalism. There's neither historical continuity nor territorial contiguity. But even leaving Chaudhry Rehmat Ali aside, if you look at what indeed happened when Pakistan was created, Pakistan, after all, is created in two pieces. East Pakistan, what is today Bangladesh, and West Pakistan, what is today Pakistan. This creation also, I think, suggests that geography is not a crucial determinant for this new nation state. There are very few examples of nation states that are made in two distinct pieces, separated, in this case, by 1,000 miles of a hostile country, India. All right. The United Arab Republic is the only one I can think of, which was a temporary arrangement whereby Egypt and Syria became a single country when Nasser was president. But the other countries that seem to be split up in this way, interestingly, are the United States, with Alaska, a large chunk of it, elsewhere, separated by Canada, and of course Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and other territories, which are much more like old-fashioned European colonial territories. Right. And I point this out so as to note that in some ways, as a geography or as a geographical idea, Pakistan is linked more to old empires on the one hand, and on the other hand to the new international order and to new world states. All right? The Soviet Union is another such example, though it was more or less contiguous. Right? So what I'd like to suggest is that older form of nationalism embodied by India, one can identify as perhaps romantic. You know, it's about history, geography, blood and soil, deep past, etc. The Pakistani one, on the other hand, is more, as it were, an enlightenment form. It's based on the pure, on a purely rational or mental imagination. Right? It could have been anywhere. It just happens to be where these people, Muslims, are in a majority. There is nothing specific about that land that makes it Pakistan. It's not like they're going on and on about the rivers of the Punjab and this. There is no great romantic imagination about the land itself. There might be for the constituent units of the country. So if you're Punjabi or if you're Bengali, then you will have all that stuff as a regional category. Because, of course, these regions predated Pakistan. But in terms of Pakistani nationalism, no romance. Not about history, not about geography, which is split up in any case. That I find extraordinary, and I'm calling it enlightenment because it, not only because it resembles in some ways the United States and other such countries, and because it's purely about, as it were, a novelty, the future. It's not about the past at all. Which is also one reason why Pakistan is a completely new name. It is a name unknown to history. Not only is it a new name, it's an acronym, a bit like the USA and the USSR, right? As we know, P for Punjab, A for Afghania, K for Kashmir, S for Sindh, and Tan for Balochistan. Bengal, as everyone knows, is conspicuous by its absence. So here you have something truly modern. A country whose name is not only entirely new, has no historical reference at all. They could have chosen a historical name. They named it after some version of Islam or something, like the new capital is eventually called Islamabad. But they don't. Not only do they give it a name unknown to history, but it's an acronym as well. Right? It's a peculiarly modern entity. There is no credence given to, in other words, history as romance, nor to geography as romance either. So as I was suggesting earlier, this vision is linked to an imperial imagination on the one hand and to an international one on the other. And let me say a bit about what I mean. This has, I think, to do with the figure of the minority, the idea of the minority, which, of course, is not something that pre-existed. Right? People only start thinking in terms of majorities and minorities quite late in the day in the 19th century. And you can see how it is that, and historians have made this argument, that once you have censuses and things like that, when you start counting people up and labeling them, as the British did, then suddenly numbers become very important. Not simply numbers in terms of, you know, how many people can be fielded in an army, but as existentially, as part of your identity, you start thinking of yourself in terms of numbers, which was not the case before, arguably. Right? And when that happens, for many reasons, complex reasons, you have the development of this idea of Hindus are a majority and Muslims are a minority. Although this needn't have been the case. Right? It's possible to come up with entirely different ways of categorizing the peoples of the subcontinent, not necessarily religiously, but it turned out to be religion. So if you're part of a minority, and of course the minority only becomes significant in a way in a putative nation state. So the funny thing about these languages of majority and minority in colonial India is that they look forward almost, they were future oriented, they looked forward to an independent sovereign state. Because only in an independent sovereign state do majorities and minorities actually have political valence, not in a colonial state. In a colonial state, of course, numbers can be used to sway the colonial power one way or the other. Right? So you have a situation in which people are very keen to stress the unity of the majority and the unity of the minority on the one hand, but also these names and these identities are future-directed, just like the idea of Pakistan itself, as an enlightenment, if you will, idea. Now, one way in which the disempowering figure of the minority could be rescued from its weakness, its political weakness, was by linking it to a much bigger, if you will, federal-type structure. I don't mean federal in terms of India, necessarily. So there's an imperial structure. And Gandhi himself was very keen on this early in his career, right? Because in the days when he still had faith in the empire, he thought the empire could transform itself. It would be the greatest contribution of Britain to transform her empire into a democracy. And if she did that, you know, she would be redeemed historically. And one of the things that would mean, it would mean at least two things. One, that India would become, as it were, the major part of the empire because of her population, right? But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the categories majority and minority would become meaningless within an imperial democracy, right? Because there are far too many factions, far too many different, you know, I mean, it's not possible. So you would actually get rid of these categories. Now, Muslim thinkers also were keen on some kind of imperial form, eventually a common commonwealth form. Right? And not only them, as I'll go on to describe. After the First World War, the empire no longer seems to be such a good model, partly because the nation state has come into being in a serious way as the categorical political unit of the future. So then you have these thinkers switching, not Gandhi, but Muslim thinkers, switching to a kind of internationalist way of thinking about how do you get rid of this problem of majority and minority and the disempowerment, putative, of the minority. All right? And pan-Islamism is one way of thinking about it. The poet and philosopher Muhammad Iqbal, for instance, writes, who is called a pan-Islamist, but what he's thinking about, and he states this, he said he would like to see an Eastern League of Nations. So they take the League of Nations, which is the internationalist form invented after the First World War, and he thinks about another kind of League of Nations, which is not Islamic, by the way, Eastern League of Nations, that includes India and other countries. Right? And there are many people who do this. All right? So in a way, I'm trying to locate the history of Pakistan within this, between these two ways of thinking, if you will, in global terms. All right? Now, once Jinnah comes to take on the leadership of the Muslim League in its, if you will, separatist stance, he too accedes to this way of thinking, right? And has been accused of being either a loyalist to the empire on the one hand or a kind of pan-Islamist on the other. But in fact, this was not entirely uncommon. So if you take the movement contemporaneous with Muslim nationalism of Zionism, about which I've written in my book, not to make the case that these are two unique nations. The whole point of my comparison is to internationalize the debate, which at the moment is too navel-gazing. It's too much about South Asia, right? It doesn't look beyond that at all. I think this debate is occurring in an international and an imperial context. That was the point of calling the book Muslim Zion. It's not to say that these two countries and these two national movements are somehow so close to each other and they're distinct and everyone else is unlike them. That is not the point. Right? So you have in early Zionism also the effort to think about a Jewish homeland within an imperial structure, either the Ottoman Empire, which is what Zionism's founding figure Theodor Herzl wanted. So he was constantly, you know, I mean, he went to see the Sultan in Constantinople, etc. Or later on, after the First World War, in the British Empire. All right. And afterwards, as Hannah Arendt, the important philosopher who wrote about these issues herself wanted, she thought that the British Commonwealth could become a kind of carapace for a Jewish national home in which majorities and minorities would no longer be an issue, right? So this is an internationalist language, which is about what you do with the problem of the minority. The minority only becomes a problem either in new nation states or in putative nation states like India, right? Only once you have the possibility of a majority does the minority become a question or a problem. And from that point, you have a kind of constant set of comparisons emerging. So, you know, where the Zionists move from talking about a national home, which could be in a commonwealth or an empire, either Ottoman or British, to a national state, so does the Muslim League. Exactly the same transit. And no less a person than Dr. Ambedkar, the Dalit leader, points this out in his book on Pakistan in 1945, Thoughts on Pakistan. So it was known at the time, right, but has disappeared from view today. Now, Jinnah refers to these Zionists, to Jewish examples, but also to Irish and German ones, right? So who does he compare the Muslims to? It's very interesting. On the one hand, not to the Catholics, because that link is between India and Ireland, right? That's about the majorities. But to Ulster, to Protestants, right? The minority. Here is Ulster, you know, threatened by a majority and looking for protection, in this case, to Britain, right? Similarly with Muslim nationalism. On the one hand, you have Ireland, therefore. On the other hand, you have the Sudetenland. That's the other big model for Jinnah, right? As you know, the Sudetenland was part of one of the new countries created after the First World War, Czechoslovakia, which had a German, that bit had a German majority, and eventually the Sudetenland became one of the causes, ostensible causes for the Second World War, because Hitler claimed it for Germany. Right? So Sudetenland is the other. Right? So you have Zionism, or European Jewry, basically, who, along with Germans, these are the two great minorities produced by the First World War in Europe, as Arendt points out, the Jews and the Germans, right, who were spread all over a large bit of Europe. So you have the Jews in Europe, you have the Protestants in Ireland, and you have the Germans in Sudetenland. These are the three primary models that Jinnah is invoking. Right? So already you see there is an international / imperial context. It's not all about Hindu-Muslim stuff. Right? That's obviously an important part of it. It's not only about the subcontinent. This is a bigger set of debates going on. Now, Zionism provides a kind of example. It's exemplary for Muslim nationalism. Again, it's Muhammad Iqbal, the poet and philosopher, now claimed as Pakistan's spiritual founder, though he died about 10 years before it was founded, who writes extensively about European Jews. And he both admires them. He admires this idea of an international Jewry. Right? He thinks that this is a great, in miniature, this is international Islam. Right? But he's also very wary because he writes very movingly about the tragedy of the Jewish people, all right? That having been deprived of a homeland, they're being made into the targets of everyone, especially in nation states. So for him, the fate of European Jewry serves, as an exemplary in two ways. On the one hand, he's kind of admiring. On the other hand, he's very, very wary of it, all right? So there are many ways in which these examples and comparisons stick to Muslim nationalism. Now, to move to the second and briefer part of my talk, which focuses on Jinnah and what he does with this background. Right? So for Jinnah, what is the problem exactly? There's a problem of majority-minority. And he initially thinks that this problem is a false problem. It can be resolved. Because why should religious identities be so primary? And he tries to resolve it in all kinds of ways as a congressman when he's a member of the Indian National Congress. Right? And he, like many of his compatriots, thinks about this problem in actually a very interesting way. And I just want to conclude by describing this. So whereas we are all aware, perhaps far too familiar with the language of communal conflict, that the problem with majority and minority relations in India or Hindu-Muslim relations is that these communities are or have been perhaps not always being at loggerheads or are part or so different and all the rest. Right? And this was, of course, the colonial way of thinking as well. But Jinnah, like Gandhi and like others, actually thought the reverse was true. That the problem was not that they were too far away from each other. The problem was they were too close to each other. They were too intimate with each other. Right? That the violence was a result of, but too intertwined. They shared too many things overlapped. Sometimes, as he put it famously in a speech, the hero of one is the villain of another. Right? One group eats something, the other one refuses to eat it. These kinds of stock, cliché kinds of oppositions. But instead of seeing these, as I said, as being markers of difference, he thinks that they're too close together, that the violence comes out of intimacy. Right? And he thinks this is so, and in doing so, he draws upon a kind of a set of reflections that were more commonplace, that are not unique to him, because interests have not been established in Indian society. Right? So this is a colonial thing. Now, you remember one of the reasons for the land settlement in Bengal, right, is precisely in order to create interests. And you create interests through property, right? That's how interest, even if you think of self-interest, you yourself become your property. You can dispose of, so the land settlement, the permanent settlement in Bengal is meant to create reforming landlords because they have full ownership of the property. The king cannot take it away from them arbitrarily. They will then reform the land and the people who are working for them, etc. All of this kind of stuff, right? Of course, it was a great failure in Bengal, but the logic of interest was widespread nevertheless. Right? So the point was, India apparently didn't have interest, therefore it had religion. Right? Interest would make people ally with others according to class, or famously class, but other things as well. Right? And interests are variable. They change when you change. When your status and wealth changes, your interests change. The problem with religion is that you're just permanently stuck in it, right? According to this way of thinking. Now, either you try to create interests where they didn't exist, or, which is something that Jinnah was keen on, like Ambedkar and like Savarkar, or like Gandhi and Iqbal, you decide that interests are actually themselves the source of violence, and it's impossible to instantiate them in India, because property can never be, in India, the basis for social relations. Therefore, we might as well do without them. It's a virtue of necessity in some ways, but also, as Gandhi might argue, the lack of interest produces disinterest. That's how people can sacrifice. You know, that's where love and idealism and all that enters politics. Right. If you were to make all social relations interested social relations, first of all, it's impossible, because it would mean destroying families, destroying all human relations cannot be mediated by property and contract. Right. Jinnah thought that there should at least be an attempt to instantiate interests. Right. He, in that way, as I said, is much more like Ambedkar and Savarkar. Then he is like Iqbal or Gandhi. So what I'm saying is that when you're dealing with these thinkers, you cannot divide them in communal terms. Right? Iqbal, in my view, belongs with Gandhi on this question. And Jinnah belongs with Savarkar and Ambedkar, with whom he actually had an alliance once upon a time, right? Even though Savarkar was a Hindu nationalist. Right? Against the Congress, they united all three of them. And when the Congress went out of power, resigned power during the Second World War, there was a day of deliverance which all three men celebrated together. So that is an important point I want to make. When we think about communal identities, we also ought to notice that you can't divide these people themselves up communally. Right? And it's important to note that. So what does Jinnah do? So he tries in the earlier bit of his career to create interests through education, through property, through nationalism. Right. He's a keen capitalist. He loves private property, like Gandhi. Gandhi, of course, doesn't want any property at all, but he supports it for others, right? And it seems to go nowhere. So he then does something quite interesting. Instead of starting with nationalism, he goes back before. He talks about a social contract. Basically, he says, look, there is no nation in India because people are immured in their caste and religious and other identities. If we were to have interests, then these would be shifting, and that would make a democracy possible. Because in a democracy, a majority can always become a minority, and a minority can always become a majority. That's where parties change in politics. If there's a permanent majority and a permanent minority, there is no democracy. Right? And the problem is, if everyone is just voting according to on communal lines, forget it. No democracy possible, no nation possible. So you can try, as he initially did, to think about, you know, encouraging capital and property and education and Indian nationalism. But he thinks eventually, by the late 30s, okay, let's try something else to instantiate interests. So the point is to actually get to the variable interests that create democracy and therefore set aside the religious loyalties that dominated Indian political life. So it's a curiously paradoxical thing, right? he goes full tilt into Muslim nationalism in order to prevent religion from becoming an important part of political identity, right? So he says, okay, let's think about the social contract. This is also a nice Enlightenment style thing to do, right? It entirely disregards history. So remember, the social contract is sort of Hobbes or Rousseau or Locke. It's all about before the nation, right? Before the polity. You need a contract in order to create something. So he said, instead of thinking that the nation already exists, let's actually think how we might create it first. And we must do so constitutionally, through a social contract. So how do you do that? You only do that by recognizing, A, that there is no nation already existing, and B, that in order for the nation to exist, you can no longer think in terms of majority and minority, because if there is no nation, there is no majority and minority. So Hindus and Muslims, even though they have different demographic weights, must be treated as equal, because all parties to a contract must be treated as equal. It's an utterly abstract way of thinking. He's a lawyer, after all, right? And so what you need to do is you say that, forget about numbers, there should be parity between Hindus and Muslims constitutionally, and they need to come together and literally sign the social contract. Once they decide what this nation is going to be, then we can move ahead. Now, you might argue, as Gandhi and congressmen did, that this is kind of chimerical way of thinking, and you know, nation states don't come into being in this manner. Right? But when partition finally happened, it's in the early days of it, before the violence took over, Jinnah is thrilled. He thinks that the amazing thing about the partition of India, which he may or may not have wanted earlier, was that it was achieved without a war, by civilians, not by the army, by people literally signing, and that he called it a social contract. He said, look, Europe has only written about the social contract. We have made it history, right? No one has ever had a social contract. We've only presumed it as it's a presumption, right? It's a myth. But here in India, we have actually created this thing. Well, he was soon to stop saying these things because the violence proved him wrong. But it's very, very interesting, I think, anyway, his mode of imagining this national. So what does this entail? By claiming parity, and by claiming that there's a two-nation theory, this is his term, the two-nation theory means nothing more than Hindus and Muslims are equals. The nation is a negative category for Iqbal. It simply means that this is a party to the contract, to the potential contract, all right? That there's parity between them because there is no nation, therefore there's no majority or minority. So he gets out of the language of minority-majority, which had completely suffused and defined Muslim politics earlier, right? By 1940, majority-minority is out. It's now parity and social contract. Occasionally, he'll still talk about minority and all that, but generally, it's out. So the nation is entirely negative for Iqbal. Therefore, he doesn't give it any... it has no ontology. He doesn't tell you what the Muslim nation is. He'll just list. There's a long list sometimes, which he just reels off, and that's it, gets rid of it. There's no attempt to create something. It's not like, unlike Congress, that they're going around saying, you know, let's create cultural institutions to, like, define and describe what our nation is, and we'll have art and music, and they are not really interested, right? It's not like they don't have time. You know, you might argue that they don't have much time, but it's not even the attempt to do it. That all starts after Pakistan is created, right? He's not interested in the cultural thing. Nation is simply a legal category. It just means you are party to a contract. It's negative. That's what the two-nation theory means. So what is it meant to do eventually? And I'll stop here. What partition is meant to do? Now, as you know, the great debates and the historiography have all been legalistic debates. Who was responsible? It's like, you know, the politicians were lawyers and the historians are also lawyers. Right? It's like, I was telling Saeed the other day, it's like a Hindi film you know, where there's a courtroom scene. And Malad, you know, you're sitting there, and Aisha Jalal is here, and someone else is there, and they're arguing, you know, who did it, who was responsible? Did Jinnah want it or it didn't want it? Was Nehru responsible? Was Gandhi responsible? Was Patel responsible? What kind of way is this to write history? I want to ask, you know. And it's been going on for 70 years. Even before independence, they were making these arguments. So I think it's a kind of absurdity. It's a betrayal of the historians, in my view, task to just continue this absurd thing. Who is the guilty party? Basically, that's what it is. I think this is a profitless enterprise. You know, and yet the historiography on partition in Pakistan has been absolutely and obsessively dominated by it. So one of the things I tried to do in my book is like, get away from this, you know. We have had it. Whatever was good about it, we've learned already. Now you just trade off these things in the Pakistani press. In Dawn, every other day, there is some article about this, right? Now, so what is happening with partition when it comes? Leaving aside whether Jinnah wanted it, didn't want it, who was responsible for it. What he says is, on more than one occasion, well, what I want to do is turn brothers into friends. It's very interesting. That's what a contract does. So he uses this image, being the lawyer that he is, of a paternal property. All right? The father dies. The father, let's say, British Raj, right? Father dies. Brothers inherit the property. They can't get along. And as you know, in the subcontinent, this is usually blamed on the wives, right? The wives don't get along and so on. So what do? You partition. The word in Hindi is batwara, in Urdu it's taksim, taksimat. Both words are domestic words as well. They're not political words. They're used for the partitioning of family property. It's interesting that those words, which are domestic words, which are used every day in family quarrels, are also the political words. And Jinnah says, look, I have fought this case before. The father has died, the brothers can't get along. Well, what do? We try to reconcile them, it doesn't, for what, many reasons, doesn't happen. Then you must partition. Because when you partition, the brothers can become friends. Brotherhood, which is a relationship of intimacy, is where the violence comes from. Because you only hate someone whom you know very well. You don't hate a stranger. Your violence is always, I want to go back to this point of intimacy, right? Which of course is also coming out of a situation where interest does not dominate. Just as with brothers, right? It's always more than interest, right? That kind of, you know, people will often go to great lengths and ruin themselves legally in order to fight their brother for a piece of meaningless property, right? So I want, the problem with Hindus and Muslims is that they're brothers. They're too close to each other. That's where the violence is coming from. So we have tried to resolve this in so many ways. It's not worked. So we should partition. And when we partition, brothers can become friends because their relationship of, as it were, blood and soil can become a contractual relationship. That's where the social contract is. And as Gandhi said in 1947 to the governor of Bengal, Lord Casey, Jinnah is wrong because he's an idealist. Jinnah thought he was a realist, of course. But in a way, Gandhi might have been right. Gandhi recognized this about Jinnah, that the arch realist of Indian politics turned out to be the most idealistic figure in it. So thank you.